At Lion's Roar, we're always looking forward to our next great discussion. That's something we share with the students and faculty at St. John's College, the sponsor of this week's episode. The Graduate Institute at St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, is for students seeking a lifelong commitment to thoughtful, collaborative inquiry into fundamental human questions. The Master of Arts in Eastern Classics examines the core literary, philosophical, and theological works of India, China, and Japan. In small, discussion-based classes, students delve into the richness of Asian traditions and study classical Chinese or Sanskrit. This three-semester program offers both online and on-campus options, so join the vibrant community of learners from all walks of life and learn more about St. John's Master of Arts in Eastern Classics at sjc.edu/lion. That will take you to the program page. Welcome to the Lion's Roar podcast from the publishers of Lion's Roar magazine and Buddha Dharma, the practitioner's guide. I'm Sandra Hannibal. This episode is also sponsored by Naropa University, where experiential learning meets academic rigor. If you want to live a purpose-driven, embodied life in order to change the world, go to naropa.edu. Money can be a taboo topic for the spiritually minded. In this segment, Lion's Roar's editor-in-chief, Melvin McLeod, sits down with Spencer Sherman, founder of a sustainable financial firm with Buddhist values, to discuss how one can grow spiritually and still engage with money. Then we'll hear from Lion's Roar editor-in-chief, Melvin McLeod, and deputy editor, Andrea Miller, about our new issue honoring both the late Thich Nhat Hanh and the late Bell Hooks, plus a special look at Pure Land Buddhism.
Hello, I'm Melvin McLeod, the editor-in-chief of Lion's Roar, and I'm joined for this conversation by Spencer Sherman, who is the co-founder of the financial firm Abacus. He is a 30-year practitioner in the Vipassana and Dzogchen meditation traditions, and his Buddhist practice informs his work with money. He is the author of The Cure for Money Madness and his new course, Your Inner Compass, Freedom on the Road to Enough, is available at spencersherman.com. He writes regularly for Lion's Roar, addressing issues revolving around our relationship with money from a Buddhist perspective. Spencer, thanks very much for joining us for this podcast.
Very happy to be here talking about this dark corner of our lives, money.
Well, in fact, that segues nicely into the first question, because as you noted in your pieces in Lion's Roar, money is a subject that many of us treat very privately, perhaps out of some sense of shame or what, and that in addition to the privacy with which most people hold money, that people with a spiritual bent, including Buddhists, may be particularly conflicted about acknowledging and working directly with issues that revolve around money. What have you found in your teaching and work about how Buddhist practitioners in general and more broadly spiritual practitioners, their attitudes and conflicts around fully looking at money in the same way that theoretically they're supposed to look at other things in their lives with full awareness?
Yeah, Melvin, there's such a taboo around speaking around money. It's as taboo as sex, religion, and politics. So we start out with from there. And then there's this added dimension that we need money, that money's necessary in our lives. And it has this label of being not being spiritual, that it's of the material world, it's of this relative world. And how do I maintain my spiritual practice, grow myself spiritually, and be engaged with something as dark as money? So there's all these conflicts around it, and yet we need it. And what I found, Melvin, is that many of us spiritual practitioners, even though we don't want to identify with money or see our self-worth connected to our net worth, it often is. we don't know that we're swimming in these waters. We don't know how conditioned we are around money. That's what I've discovered, that the conditioning is so deep that just because we started meditating in our 20s or 30s doesn't mean that we've undone the conditioning. Because in Buddhist circles, we don't talk about money. Teachers don't talk about money. I think there's probably even more focus on sexuality than there is money. So the conditioning is just so strong around these beliefs that we develop early on. Don't talk about money. Certainly don't tell anyone how much money you have. Money is evil. Money is difficult. Only those people have money. If you have money, you have to hide it. It's shameful. I just had someone emailed me from a workshop I did at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, and she said, I didn't feel comfortable asking this question in the room, but I want to know, how do I feel okay about flying first class? How do I let go of the shame of flying first class? It's a complex question. And I gave her many different possible ways of holding that question. But these are the kinds of issues that we wrestle with from, you know, the people who have money wrestle with the shame. The people who don't have money wrestle with, why is it so difficult to gain money?
So
and then there's all these systemic forces in place that keep many of us from having money.
So I think you're doing something quite unique in the Buddhist world, which is not only are you talking about money, but you're specifically bringing Buddhist insight and practice to bear on helping us to work with our relationship with money. So I'd like to look at a couple of different ways in which that might work. And one of them, which you've written about often for Lion's Roar, is how Buddhist practice as awareness, as you've just suggested, of our various forms of conditioning can help us work with the personal suffering that many of us find in our relationship with money. So how can Buddhist practice or philosophy help us to suffer less when it comes to how we relate to money?
Well, this is why I'm here, Melvin. This is why I find this field so incredibly exciting. Like, I get goosebumps because we've been so conditioned, like I mentioned, with money, with our beliefs around money. They're so ingrained in us. Because this is such a taboo, dark corner of our lives, the opportunity is immense. There's so much suffering we can undo by just giving this topic some conscious attention. And it starts, as you've hinted at, with starting to bring awareness to our money activities, to the way we spend money, to the way we save money, to the way we give money or don't give money, to the way we earn money, to how we talk about it or not talk about it with our friends, our family members, our coworkers, is to start being aware of what's arising in those moments when we're interacting with money, to notice that when the stock market crashes like it's been doing in the last few months, what is our tendency with when something like that happens? Do we tend to have this reactivity around, I've got to do something about it? Or are we able to sit back and rest in a place of equanimity and come and respond with wisdom? So there's countless opportunities to practice with money because it pops up so often. In pretty much every day of our lives, there are thoughts and interactions with money.
So these attitudes that we have around money not only cause us to suffer, anxiety, fear, hope, guilt, all kinds of things, but in addition, they can cause us to actually make concrete, unskillful or bad decisions around money. Now, I don't think anybody would claim, least of all you, that bringing Buddhist practice to bear on our relationship with money will make us rich. But to what extent can it help us to be wiser and to make more skillful and better financial decisions?
Yeah, well, you know, just in that example, the way we react to things happening, often to bad news, like we lose a job or the stock markets fall, and immediately we go into this try to fix it mode. We have this very reactive response to that. And often those reactive responses are not the wisest responses. So if we can learn how to pause, and I think Buddhist practices teach us to be with the discomfort. So instead of trying to get rid of the discomfort when the markets go down, or I lose my job, or my business suffers a bad quarter, can I be with that discomfort inside? Can I notice what's going on? Can I start to use the discomfort around money as grist for the mill? Can that be a tool for my spiritual growth? It's sort of like, I like to say, when you're noticing that discomfort, don't kill the messenger. Because of all the conditioning that we've had with money, we tend to be very reactive. We tend to be almost like, we're not in our adult selves. We're in a very primitive, unevolved self around money. And when the markets fall precipitously, we tend to overreact and try to fix that. When we lose our job, when our businesses have a bad quarter, we want to do something immediately about that instead of sitting with that, being with that discomfort. And the other part thing about money is that we have this inherent tendencies towards greed, aversion, delusion, and particularly with money, it's hard to get away from that. I mean, there's so much noise in the culture telling us to want more, to always go for more, that there's never enough. And that clinging, that wanting of money, and it's true even amongst us Buddhist practitioners, for the most part, there is this inherent desire for more. Like, maybe it's just, well, if I had more, then I'd be able to do more philanthropy. But there still is this grasping for more. And it's that grasping for more that leads us to suffer. It also ironically sometimes leads us to have less money because of that grasping. We're not seeing the opportunities.
We've been talking now about how we, you know, Buddhist meditation and can lead us to bring awareness to bear on our attitudes and actions around money. But of course, the other great component of Buddhism with awareness is compassion. And you have written in Lion's Roar about applying, for instance, the four Brahma Viharas, the four highest emotions, to our relationship to money. So what would you say would be some examples of how we can bring the compassion side of Buddhist practice to bear on our relationship with money?
Wow. Well, compassion is this, sometimes I'll say it's this powerful weapon. It's really, compassion has transformed my life, and specifically with a money situation. So I got this message, this belief I inherited from my father that money is the most important thing in the world. And that belief that money is the most important thing in the world, you know, led me to enter a building that was unsafe. A fire was being put out, but I entered the building to retrieve my worthless material stuff because I had this belief that was overriding all my common sense that money is paramount. And it wasn't until I started doing a very committed compassion practice. Let me say that again. It wasn't until I started doing a very intentional compassion practice around this belief and around my father that things started to shift. And it took months. So I started this compassion practice for this belief that I had as a young child that I acquired. So I saw the child and started feeling compassion for this younger version of myself. I started feeling compassion for my father, you know, for the conditioning that he had that led him to give me that message that money is so important. And nothing seemed to change for weeks. And then around the 2-month mark, I started feeling this immense freedom. And I no longer felt this clutching for more. I no longer felt myself measure myself, my self-worth, according to how much money I had.
You know, you've sort of pointed to what you could see as a two-step process in which initially you have to actually be aware that you have these attitudes. Mm. Often that are soaked into us as children and cause us to suffer. And then after, you know, you are aware that those attitudes exist, then you can have compassion for the often young person who's had all kinds of anxieties and fearfulnesses and insecurities around money inculcated in them. And so, you know, and in the end, awareness without compassion really probably doesn't go anywhere. It's compassion that really soaks change into us.
Yes, yes. And the thing about these beliefs that it took me a while to learn is that one doesn't have to get rid of a belief. Because I thought that belief that money is the most important thing in the world, Melvin, is a pretty yucky belief. I just wanted to eliminate it, to make it disappear. And then I realized, no, these beliefs are in us. And the only thing we have to do, and this is, you know, my opinion very much folds into Buddhism, is just loosen our grip on the belief.
So, and it's about us.
Loosen the grip on us. Exactly. Exactly. That's all we have to do is loosen its grip on us and we start to be able to develop this friendly relationship. So now when that belief arises in my mind, oh, money is paramount, I'm able to just relax and befriend that voice and then make a new choice.
Yeah. So we've been talking about how Buddhist practice and philosophy can be applied and help us in our relationship with money. But let's now reverse that equation and look at how relating to money can actually help us in our overall spiritual path. I mean, many people talk about things like arts or creativity, and you could say, okay, well, you know, a Buddhist practice can help your artistic practice. But conversely, the artistic practice can itself be a part of the practice. And yet we rarely do that with something as we're conflicted about as money. So, you know, is there a way in which not simply we bring Buddhism to bear to help us with our money practice, as it were, but can our money practice help us with our Buddhist practice?
Well, that's what I feel has happened with me, that money has been this amazing teacher to me. I mean, if it wasn't for me entering that building that was on fire, I might not have uncovered this belief that, as you were saying, many of us are not aware of our beliefs. I wasn't aware of that belief that I had. So our money practice often illuminates, or, you know, our money practice or our interactions with money often illuminate these beliefs within us. We gain awareness of beliefs that are guiding us without us knowing it. And money gives us so many opportunities to practice that we don't have to wait to sit on the cushion. We have all these opportunities when we're spending money or saving money, or talking with others about money, we have an opportunity to gain awareness of what's arising, what emotions, what sensations are arising. Where are we feeling tightness in the body when we're talking about splitting the check with somebody else at lunch or paying it ourselves? What's happening in those moments? These are very ripe opportunities for learning, for developing our Buddhist practice. And then there's this whole idea of enough. And I feel that Buddhism is so much about letting go of grasping, which is so counter to our American culture, even amongst Buddhists. I mean, we just want more. We want more meditations. We want nicer cushions. We want a nicer meditation hall. And to finally use the practice as a way to experience a sense of enough right now in this moment, not in an hour, not next year, not when I finish that silent retreat next week, but what about right now? And I feel like this money is this incredible tool for making that happen, because we know there's so much evidence that more money does not bring us peace. There have been countless studies on this. And of course, we have the famous quote from John D. Rockefeller, the world's first billionaire, when someone asked him, how much is enough? Essentially, how much do you need to get to equanimity? And his answer was just a little bit more. Yeah. Well, I think that's very informative, that if we can find this place of equanimity, this place of sufficiency, of enoughness, it's liberating.
And we can use our relationship with money to bring that sense of equanimity and enoughness to all other aspects of our life. So in effect, you could do something quite radical, which is to say, you know, while many people have talked about things like, oh, the artistic path.
Yeah.
In effect, we're saying, or you're saying that there's a money path.
Yeah.
That in itself can be a spiritual path.
Yes, absolutely. Melvin, the money path is in itself a spiritual path, and in part because we've put so little attention on it, and it causes us a lot of suffering. And suffering is the doorway to transformation. It alerts us. It's that messenger that tells us, hey, we need to look at this. And money kind of roars its ugly head often.
Yeah.
And hopefully we get to see it before something too catastrophic happens. But even so, these are incredible opportunities to apply the Dharma. And, you know, it's funny because sometimes when I'll teach, Melvin, I'll remember that the Dharma is not so much about being a good meditator. It's not about reaching these higher states of awareness. It's about applying all of this to our daily lives. It's about suffering less in our lives, so we have more availability for our friends and family members. And as you said, you mentioned about that if we can find this place of enough with money, we can also find it with other things like enough time, enough friends. I mean, often even the Buddhists amongst us are saying, I'm out of time, I'm overly booked. And where's the spaciousness in that? How do we get to a place where we're not feeling this sense of scarcity with time? Because that scarcity kind of, it almost implies a sense of fear. And I feel like Buddhist practices are so powerful at helping us dissolve fear, and fear of running out of time, running out of money, fear of death. I mean, this is why Buddhist practice has become so popular, because it helps us deal with the most terrifying and challenging issues that we go through as human beings.
Maybe we could conclude now with looking at one specific kind of attitude that people have around money, or a pair of attitudes, and you could analyze how to address them from a Buddhist point of view. So, these two attitudes, which are basically being too tight with money and being too loose with money. And as we all know, the Buddha famously said, the middle way, you know, the musician asked him how to tune his instrument, and the Buddha said, well, not too tight and not too loose. And that's almost a definition of the middle way. But many people have one of those two attitudes. They're too tight with money, they're too fearful, they're too insecure. The converse is they're too loose with it. They may not be sufficiently responsible, may not be sufficiently caring for the future. And indeed, many people in relationships, well, I would say almost all of them, find that the two partners may have be at somewhat on different poles in that equation. So, I mean, how would you recommend that each of us work with our own particular attitude, whether we're on the too tight side or the too loose side, the holding on to money too tightly or letting it go too freely side? And how would a couple, for instance, deal with the fact that they each would probably differ in that respect, that one would be normally more on the too tight side and the other too loose side, and then they have to negotiate that?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And what the first thing that's coming to me is a question that I like to ask people is, if you were advising a friend of yours, and let's imagine that this friend has exactly your financial situation, they're tight with money or loose with money, just the way you are. They're fearful about money careless with money, just the way you are. How would you advise this person? Now, to do this exercise, you really have to come into a place of beginner's mind. You really have to let go of all of your conditioning in order to be a good advisor to this person. But what I've found is that when I've asked people to do that, they often find that their own wisdom comes through. They'll say something brilliant because they're advising. I mean, it's a contrived situation, but it's contrived for a good reason, so that we can come forth with our objectivity instead of the same old thoughts that are in our minds. So that's one exercise I've done with people that it's often sprung something they unexpected to their minds when they're forced to advise someone else. It helps us leap into an objective place. Other things that I've had people do in these, when they're feeling to sort of come, as you say, more towards this middle way, is acceptance is so important. Compassion is to have compassion for the tightness within yourself, for the looseness within yourself. And as I said before, don't try to get rid of anything. Don't try to get rid of any beliefs. What if you just become more aware of the tightness and sort of loosen the grip on that tightness, just to befriend that tightness. And it's that befriending of the tightness or the befriending of the looseness that I think will bring us freedom, will bring us ideas on how to work with that more. I remember I had two clients, both were children of Holocaust survivors. And one said, well, obviously, I'm a spender because you don't know what's going to happen in life. A Holocaust could strike at any moment. So therefore, one should just spend all their money today. They just spend it because you never know when it's going to disappear. And then I had this other client who had this opposite attitude. She was like, no, we have to save our money because you never know what's going to happen. So you can have these different attitudes to the same experience in life. And I think the way through that to lessen the effect of the tightness or of the looseness, to help us come to this middle way, is through compassion. And then in a couple situation, what I've often said is, why not trade places? So often when people get together in a couple situation, even if you have two tight people, two frugal people who can't spend any money, there'll be a natural polarization will happen over time. And because you can't both stay in that saving mode forever or in the spending mode forever, but at some point, why not trade places for a few days? Maybe act out the role of the other person. So if you're the spender, you talk about saving money for the next couple of days. It's another contrived exercise, but it works. It also often brings laughter, and that's very much needed with money because we're in these very tight ways with it. So that's been effective as well. Even to going so far as to, for that person who never spends, to say, let's go out for dinner tonight, and kind of force yourself to spend some money. And you can do this if you're not in a couple situation. Take a week and just say, for this week, I'm going to do the opposite of my tendencies. And that will often be illuminating. You'll start to feel the discomfort that will spring forward. And that's something to investigate. That's an incredible opportunity to do the RAIN practice, that acronym that stands for recognize, allow, investigate, and nurture or non-identify. Doing a practice like that when you have all this discomfort coming up can be very helpful.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Spencer, I want to really thank you for bringing both your long Buddhist practice as well as your professional expertise to bear on the issue of money, which is such a rich source of suffering, both objective and psychological, and therefore such a rich ground for awakening. So I think the work you're doing is very helpful. I found it helpful to me personally in reading what you've been writing for Lion's Roar, and I'm sure many of the people listening to this will find it very helpful as well. So thanks very much for joining us. I'm Melvin McLeod, Editor-in-Chief of Lion's Roar.
Thank you, Melvin.
This episode is lovingly sponsored by Naropa University. Recognized as the worldwide leader in contemplative education, Naropa University takes an approach to learning and teaching that integrates Eastern wisdom studies and traditional Western scholarship. This allows intellectual knowledge and intuitive wisdom to work together, resulting in a sense of purpose and moral clarity that drive professional success and a life of service. Naropa offers bachelor and master degrees in psychology, creative writing, divinity, yoga, and more. Learn more at naropa.edu. Next, Lion's Roar editors Melvin McLeod and Andrea Miller take a look at our new issue celebrating Thich Nhat Hanh after his passing in January at age 95.
Hi, it's Melvin McLeod, and I'm back now again to talk with Deputy Editor Andrea Miller about the new issue of Lion's Roar. And this issue of the magazine is very fittingly, almost exclusively devoted to honoring one of the great Buddhist teachers of our time, Thich Nhat Hanh, who has died recently. Andrea, you wrote the lead piece for this issue, looking at both Thich Nhat Hanh's extraordinary life, as well as the experiences you had both attending his programs and as a student of his. So why don't you tell us a bit about what you wrote about?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Melvin. So as you mentioned, it's a story about his life. I weave together his life with my experiences going on retreat with him and how I've been sort of nourished by his teachings. And one thing that really struck me after he passed and I was attending some of the online events is just how many people he touched in the course of his life. There were just so many people attending these events and writing comments and saying thank you for everything that all the teachings that he'd given and all the love and warmth that he'd given out. So I was just thinking about, you know, how he had touched my life. And one thing that didn't manage to make it into the story is how he transformed my relationship to meditation. And by that I mean when I first started really delving into Buddhist teachings, the teachings themselves really resonated with me. I was totally on board with the teachings, but what wasn't really working for me was actually the practice. I didn't enjoy the practice of meditation. It just felt like a struggle to sit still. I just almost want to like run out of my skin whenever I sat down to meditate. And it really wasn't until I encountered Thich Nhat Hanh that changed. I was kind of put off when I would talk to other teachers and other people, and I would say, well, how do I deal with the fact that I don't really enjoy this? And there was this thread of, well, it's not supposed to be fun. It's so you're just sort of muscle through it. It had this very kind of like macho kind of feeling for me. But when I asked Thich Nhat Hanh in an interview, I had the opportunity to interview him. I asked him, so what would you recommend for someone who doesn't enjoy sitting? And he said, oh, well, don't do it. He said, you know, there's enough suffering in this world. If it makes you feel terrible, well, don't do it. But the key is that if you're sitting in the correct way, it's actually very pleasurable. It's like sitting on a lotus. So it was the way he was sort of tapped into the joy and the pleasure of sitting. And that really changed my relationship to meditation. But I just really appreciate this about Thay in general, that he had a real sense of enjoyment in the world.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Indeed, since Buddhism is supposed to be about the end of suffering, it shouldn't itself cause more suffering, and indeed should make us happy. I think by my reckoning, there are three marks of a great teacher. The first and perhaps most important is the depth of his or her teachings, how profound and universal they are. The second is the width or breadth of their teachings. Do they apply across the spectrum of human life? In some sense, then, the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh are like a great river in the sense that they are both extremely deep and very wide. And finally, the third factor is the example of their own life and what that tells us about what a good human life is, what awakening is, what a kind heart and wise mind are. And by all three of these scores, I think Thich Nhat Hanh ranks among the greatest teachers of our time. The depth of his teachings are sometimes missed by those who find them overly simple. But in fact, in this life, the greatest profundity is found in simple statements, not complex ones. His teachings, as we know, have been applied across the full range of human activity, from personal realization and happiness to the nature of community to political and social change. And as we've indicated, his own life of great courage strength and depth of commitment to Buddhism, it sets an example for all of us. So following Andrea's story in this issue, we have a variety of tributes to and stories about Thich Nhat Hanh that I think will exemplify for readers both the depth, the breadth, and the breadth of Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings. So we have a number of personal tributes by people who knew Thich Nhat Hanh and were touched by him personally, showing that his wisdom and teachings came not just in the form of formal lectures, but informal encounters in which he transmitted his mind and heart directly on the spot to those close to him. To people like the great writer Rebecca Solnit and Alan Sanaki, talking about Thich Nhat Hanh's impact on the world of activism, bringing a Buddhist approach and insight to social and political change. We have also a direct teaching by Thich Nhat Hanh, to conclude, which is, I think, an example of his almost unique contribution, a combination of both profundity and practicality in this teaching on how to water the seeds of happiness, brings together traditional Buddhist understanding of how the mind works, the roots of happiness and unhappiness, along with modern understandings that he brings to bear and combines with traditional Buddhist thought. This is a man, after all, who represented in his youth both traditional Buddhist education in Vietnam as well as a deep interest and knowledge of contemporary global, in this case, primarily French, thought and philosophy. And I think for the remainder of his life, he brought together both the best of modern thought and understanding with the best of traditional Buddhist wisdom. So I think overall, you're going to find that this issue brings together both teachings by Thich Nhat Hanh, reflections by people like Andrea and those close to him, that will really give you a sense of this man and I think what will end up being his historic contribution to the world as one of the great Buddhist teachers of our time. I'm looking now at the section that always concludes Lion's Roar, Explore Buddhism, is in this issue on the subject of Pure Land Buddhism, albeit perhaps the world's most popular form of Buddhism, may be something that American readers are not deeply familiar with. Andrea, you put together this collection of stories about Pure Land Buddhism. Why don't you tell us a bit about them?
Yeah, sure. So I think, first of all, I'd like to explain, because maybe a lot of our listeners don't know this, but when people use the term Pure Land Buddhism, it can refer to one of two things. So it can either be the Pure Land teachings that are integral to diverse schools of Mahayana Buddhism. And it could be, it doesn't matter what particular school of Mahayana Buddhism that is. But then the second meaning of Pure Land Buddhism is that it's the name of a particular branch of Mahayana Buddhism. And that was a branch of Buddhism that developed, it's based on the Pure Land teachings, and it developed out of Japan. So in our Explore Buddhism on Pure Land, we delve into both of those different but ultimately connected meanings of Pure Land Buddhism. So we start out with a teaching on the philosophy of Pure Land Buddhism, so to kind of get the ground of Pure Land Buddhism. And this is a teaching by Takashi Miyagi, and he really explains who Amitabha Buddha is, or Amida Buddha, and how he's central to Pure Land Buddhism, and how anyone can achieve liberation through him. And then from there, we go to another teaching, this one by Alex Kikuyo, and this is about Pure Land practice, the Pure Land practice of chanting the Nembutsu. So that is Namu Amida Butsu, and that translates to I take refuge in Amida Buddha. And then we have another piece, and this one is by Aaron Prophet, and he's a scholar, and he explains the history of Pure Land Buddhism. And so he starts with the time of the Buddha, and he goes all the way to the present day. And one thing that I think I'd want to point out about what Aaron shares is he goes into some of the reasons why so many white convert Buddhists don't really know that much about Pure Land Buddhism, as you mentioned, Melvin. And that has unfortunately been due to some racism and some cherry picking of Buddhist teachings within convert Buddhism. So it's important to understand, given how little we know about Pure Land Buddhism, it's really important to understand that Pure Land Buddhism is arguably the most commonly practiced form of Buddhism in the world. So then finally, we wrap up Explore Buddhism, this edition of Explore Buddhism, with Jean-Paul de Guzman, who shares with us the history and also the very vibrant present of Pure Land Buddhist communities in the U.S. And so in this case, he's really talking about the Jodo Shinshu and the Jodo Shu communities. And so those are two schools of Pure Land Buddhism, as in the school of Buddhism that originated in Japan, but that now in America are really thriving American Buddhist communities.
Yes, I think providing more and more material about and from Pure Land sources is a very important initiative for Lion's Roar. As we know, the so-called mainstream Buddhist conversation, dominated as it is by white convert Buddhists, has largely focused on the meditation-oriented traditions of Vipassana, Zen, and Tibetan Buddhism. And I have to say that Lion's Roar has been guilty of that for a long period of time. But that is not a fair representation of Buddhism, nor is it a fair representation of the whole of the North American Buddhist community. And as part of our mission to try to create connections among all Buddhists, as well as to create understanding of all different Buddhist traditions so that everybody can benefit from them, we have made it part of our a strong initiative to be able to represent, to discuss, and hear Pure Land voices more and more. And I think that all people in our audience who would like to know more about Pure Land, its key figures, its history, and its current communities will really benefit a lot from this Explore Buddhism we put together, Andrea. Finally, in this issue, we pay homage to another voice we have lost, along with Thich Nhat Hanh, and that is the voice of our dear friend and frequent contributor, Bell Hooks. I think with Thich Nhat Hanh, she was one of the great exponents and voices for love in our world today. Bell and I became very good friends many years ago, and I would always see her when I was in New York, and I remember one time in particular, I was there with my daughter, and we all went out together, and I watched as Belle and my daughter window shopped in the West Village for very fancy women's shoes. And I have to admit, the appeal of Manolo Blahniks and such has always been a bit of a mystery to me, but I enjoyed how the two of them came together to ooh and awe over these somewhat strange creations. Belle was a marvelous person, so open and straightforward, outrageous, and above all, brilliant. She, as we know, was a major thinker and theorist in a wide range of areas, from feminism to race in American society, to political theory, to cultural criticism, to movie criticism, popular culture. An extraordinary, prolific writer and a flexible mind. And yet I found that always across all of these different areas in which she applied her brilliance, there was always one theme she brought to bear, which was the theme of love. As I was reading the story in Lion's Roar that we have republished in her honor, called Toward a Revolution of Love, I was thinking that really in the end, all virtue are simply variations of love. And I think Belle, both in these individual areas and in her broad call for a society based on love, exemplifies that. I think also in a political sense, the key insight she points to is that the opposite of a society based on love, of a relationship based on love, is one based on domination. So for her, as she explains in this brilliant piece, a very important piece, Toward a Revolution of Love, the choice we face as a society, as well as individuals, is between love and domination. And of course, the right choice is love. So Belle, thanks very much for your friendship and for your contribution to this world. We will miss you. So that's our look at this issue of Lion's Roar. And I think you'll both enjoy it and benefit from it You might even love it. Thanks very much, Andrea.
Thank you, Melvin.
Thanks for listening. Mission-driven, nonprofit, and community-supported, Lion's Roar offers Buddhist teachings, news, and perspectives so that the understanding and practice of Buddhism flourishes in today's world, and its timeless wisdom is accessible to all. We do this by providing as many entry points as we can through print and digital publications, website, video, social media, online courses, practice retreats, and more. We try to bring Dharma to people right where they are, knowing the difference it can make in their lives. You can help us spread the Dharma by leaving ratings and reviews. Or go to lionsroar.com to subscribe and get unlimited access to online articles, new magazine issues, and several collections, plus perks and exclusives from Lion's Roar Magazine and Buddha Dharma, the Practitioner's Guide.